The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Afternoon. Thanks for showing up. Let's go ahead and pray. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the opportunities you've given us all to teach, to be involved with teaching. I thank you for art, for the world you've given us, the art you've given us to imitate. I pray that you'd make us wise, make us savvy in our pursuit of it, especially in our instruction of it. In your son's name, amen. Okay, so I titled my talk, Stinking at Art and How to Stop. Originally, I phrased that a little more strongly than stinking at art, and then thought it was wise to dial it back a little bit. But at the same time, just know that I feel more strongly about how badly we typically stink at art. And it's on one hand, I don't really know why we are, and when I say we, I mean Christians collectively, especially conservative Christians. Believing Christians, Christians who actually read the Bible and think this is true, those Christians, us, we typically look at our artists, at our artifacts, our galleries, and what do we have in them? You know, do we have a great canon of masterworks, poetry, prose? You know, do we have great canvases on the walls of, you know, from the last 100 years? You know, you can go back and you can find some fabulous stuff. But the last 100 years, how exactly have we done? How have we performed? And all this is always about repairing the ruins. This is always about getting back to something that was lost. And I think one of the greatest signs that we really have lost something is when you look at what's on our walls, what's in our churches, what is this giant felt thing, and is that a dove? You know, is it? And it's like, well, somebody's aunt had a whole bunch of excess fabric, and so we put something together, and there it is in the sanctuary. That's our approach now. And, you know, it can be well-received. I mean, in some hands, you could look at it and say, well, it's kind of like the widow's mite. You know, right? Is that, it's all we got. That's the extent of our abilities right now. It's the only color we had. You know, then rest easy. God will receive it. God's not a perfectionist. God's not going to stress out and refuse to receive our artistic offerings when we're in the state we're in. We do our best. At the same time, we're supposed to be achieving something much greater than this, and we know it can be done because we're all involved in classical education, and we all know what's back there. We've all seen it, even if it's only in a tacky screensaver of the cathedrals of Europe. You know, we see that go by. You can look at those stained glass windows. You can look at those paintings and know that we really have fallen a long, long way. We're way down now. So how do we even begin to get back? And I don't think we can. At first, I think we're without excuse. We just have to kind of collectively acknowledge we, of all people, are without excuse. We, the people who actually believe that God is an artist, that this is God's art. This is what he has shaped. This is what he's given us, that we're living in his stories, in his grand master story. We who have the Psalms and believe that the Holy Spirit was behind them, we who have those things are without excuse. So given that, how do we even start getting back? How do we start repairing the ruins? First, we kind of have to understand where we came from, you know, exactly how we got here, to retrace our steps a little bit. What was the pattern of the fall here before we just try to bootstrap ourselves back up? And I think it's really important to realize that we have always, and this goes for our really, really successful artist brothers of the centuries past, we have, for most of our Christian history, been very, very intimidated by pagan art. Like, it's been intimidating to us. You look at the Pantheon, you look at the Parthenon, you look at these different great structures, then you look at the neoclassical movement. You say, okay, so what exactly were we doing? Were we plundering the Egyptians, or were we, you know, looking to the wrong sources? Were we competing with them? Were we trying to surpass them? Were we trying to create something greater, or were we just copying their stuff? Now, we're in a different position now because you look at the world and their stuff is bad. So we can say we shouldn't copy their stuff. But when the world's product is really, really impressive, what do you do then? It's like, how do you behave then? And that was the position that, you know, the ones we look to, the greats, the architects and artists and so on, that's the position they were in. The world had actually achieved some really impressive stuff. And we know that. We try to glean from that. And so did they. But there was always a relationship of intimidation. It's been there for a long, long time. But that fell away. When Christian art really reached its zenith, and I say zenith because it's not yet been matched. We will get back. It won't be a zenith forever. But for now, it's a zenith. When we have the High Middle Ages, and you see these cathedrals, and you see that glasswork, and that stonework, you see that sculpture and those paintings, and that poetry, on down through the Elizabethan era. I mean, up through the almost to the foundation of this country, early 1600s, Elizabethan art, prose, poetry, playwriting. It's like we really kind of peaked there as Christendom, with a lot of problems as well. When we reached that zenith is when we were no longer intimidated. It's like that's when you see somebody like a Shakespeare really grab an old play, rip it to shreds, and redo it, like improving it. You know, not sort of bending down in front of it, but saying, hey, there's something here. Overhaul, shuffle, trash. Let's do this again. And when he actually doesn't rip it to pieces and rebuild it is when his plays stink. So when he fails and when those stories are garbage is when he's taking too much. He wants the tragic from the pre-Christian era, for example, but it no longer exists. So he's grabbing an element that was futility and despair and sorrow from some, you know, from a people that really never could find hope or salvation, and he copies it, but he does it in a post-Christian, you know, time, and you just can't. You know, it doesn't work anymore. He's betraying something. So we have to realize that we're not alone. I mean, when you see little Christian kids getting intimidated by Hollywood or by storytelling from pagans, you know, that's not new. Like, that's not a new thing. We're not unique in our relationship to the art of the world. In fact, we're in a better place than those medievals were. Because those medievals were looking at a world that had really, really achieved something great. And we have modernism, efficiency, factories, and so on. We've achieved flat screens. We've achieved technology. But has the world really achieved great art? And the answer is not really, not in a long time. Why are we so intimidated? Also, the history of artists, the relationship of artists to the church, of artists to culture, and so on. We have artist slaves. On one hand, we've got artist craftsmen. That's more the Hebraic thing. You know, you go find the best guys, gather them together, and here's what I want you to do. This is what they're going to do in the tabernacle. This is what they're going to do in the temple. Go find the best ones. There's no sign that these guys are slaves at all. Some of them may have been, especially later with temple work, but the tabernacle, you're just talking about the guys who were good, the guys who'd gotten really, really good. Bring them in, let them do their work, let them do their business here. We also have artists, priests. I think about, look through the prophets. How, you know, read Isaiah. Is that guy lacking skill? You know, is he inefficient with his words? Does he fail at communicating or moving? No, of course not. This is, you know, an artist, priest slash prophet, somebody who can really move, who can speak with power, who can affect people with rhythms, with execution, with metaphor, and so on. There's real profound art there, and yet we look at it like, even if we're not from the more premillennial side of things, we look at those things like they're riddles, and that's it. Not like they're narratives, not like they're pieces, not like they're masterpieces, in fact. And we need to shift that. Now, one of the problems is we also frequently, at least in my experience, talking to Christians who are trying to repair the ruins, they think things like, oh, wow, Michelangelo. There we were. That was success. Well, not really. I mean, this is an artist slave. First, an artist noble who wasn't allowed to work with his hands because that was, you know, corrupting. That was tacky to work with your hands. And so he became famous for sitting there and staring at marble. So the David story of him sitting there for days on end, for months on end, not touching the rock, just sitting there staring at it. And he'd come into work and sit there and stare, and then he'd leave over and over and over again. And eventually he finally touched it and it became the David. But he's also basically locked in the Sistine Chapel. You know, he was enslaved by the church and forced to paint. So he tried to run. It's like threat of excommunication, physically arrested, grabbed, dragged in, forced to paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling. It's like that's the work of a slave, not a free man. And artist slaves inevitably become artist revolutionaries. It's like that's just what happens. And so later, when you see the humanism in the David, and you see him rebelling against things, a lot of things in his work, it shouldn't be surprising to us that Michelangelo had a bad attitude about a lot of things. And that comes out in his artwork. You shouldn't take your kids and say, look at that, it's wonderful. It's the, you know, one more product of evil, and you've got a bitter, angry artist painting this, basically, in his cell. I mean, that's functionally what that is. And now if you go and you walk in there, there's going to be somebody standing there saying, shh, shh, no photographs, shh, be respectful, which is what happened to me and my kids. I really liked standing there. I enjoyed it immensely. And I'm standing next to some Koreans who are sneaking the cameras out, trying to photograph. And there's some guy, you know, ready to slap people and yelling, be respectful. It's like, which is respect? It's like the guy running around yelling and the keeper of the cell where poor Michelangelo was locked, or the person who actually admires it. Where is the respect? There's all sorts of misunderstandings. We say, well, artists should be craftsmen, but we still look down on craftsmen. Like they're not really leaders. Artists should be priests. Yes, sure. They should be. Priests of what? And a lot of them, the great artists, I think, always are priests. The question is just, what's their religion? What was Da Vinci's religion? You know, Michelangelo, what did he start preaching after his relationship with the church became too much for him? And, you know, and you see all sorts of humanism, you see rebellion. They begin pushing their revolutionary ideas. In the Elizabethan era, we actually had noblemen trained in the classics. It's like these are men like Sir Philip Sidney, who really did get the kind of education we would all aspire to give the kids that we teach. You know, those guys who could, you know, write their own version, set their own version of the Psalms to meter, who could do their own translations of the Psalms, who were in and out of multiple languages, could go direct to the primary sources, and yet were still leaders politically. You know, were cultural leaders. They weren't locked up in an academy or shut off in a university. These were guys who led, who discovered, who founded new nations, who protected existing nations, and yet they were artists and great artists. And then very, very quickly after that, we showed up, the United States showed up, and our great excuse, and it's a good one, is that we had to survive. So we were busy. For a long time, we were just busy, and that's it. And early American art looks like we were busy. So we needed to stick around. And we had a Christian nation, and it was exciting, and we had to survive. And then by the time we actually had the available man hours to go after the luxury of artistic representation of our story and the world around us, we were already beginning to fade, drifting into humanism. And so you see that really, really early on in our own stuff. And more than any, and this is not just because I'm a writer, although that's a huge part of it. I will jump up and down and say that when it comes time to actually talk about art requirements, does every kid need to be able to produce a great canvas? No, of course not. Does every kid need to be able to understand what's on a canvas, criticize what's on a canvas, message-wise, worldview-wise, or even, you know, on an aesthetic basis? And I'd say, yeah, we should aim for that. Like, that should be a minimum requirement. But that's with painting. When it comes to words and verbal art forms, all of us are artists. Whether we're great artists, good artists, mediocre artists, all of us are artists. There will be no child who goes through the world not attempting to communicate. It's like Communication is what we do. We will communicate, whether it's with words, with sign language, with written pictures, you know, whatever you can come up with. Some form of communication, one to another, will happen. Communication with peers, communication with friends, neighbors, ultimately with their own children. They will be storytellers. And one of the things I can go off, absolutely, you can ask former NSA students of mine, if you want to light a fuse and watch me explode, you just need to have a girl tell me, I'm just going to be a mom. And I will freak out. I'll lose it completely. Just going to be a mom. Don't worry, I'm just going to shape the narrative of future generations. That's all I'm going to do. Don't make me learn anything. I'm just going to be the mediator of the world's narratives for my children. That's all. That's it. And I don't want to go off on that tangent. But I can. And I can become quite rude about it. And have many times before. But every year, I will encounter some tired girl who's doing way too much work, is reading more than she's ever read, trying to understand everything, trying to see the world, you know, the way she ought to. And it feels like too much. And honestly, the cop-out is, well, that's it. I'm just, you know, I'm for breeding purposes only. You know, like, that's the cop-out. Please. I mean, that's horrifying to me. Absolutely horrifying to me. Because dads frequently are the ones who are, like the early Americans, forced to fight the battle of survival. Moms are going to be the mediators of art. I mean, most often, that's how it's going to work. They're the ones who have these kids, who are shaping these kids, and dads should be as involved as they can be. They should be doing all sorts of art criticism over the dining room table. They should be watching movies with their kids and going at it. But moms are there more. Moms are pointed at these children, shaping these children, working on how these children see things, see the world, hiding their eyes from certain things, opening their eyes to certain things, preparing them to be totally blindsided by the art of the world, or preparing them to go at it head on. Just going to be a mom doesn't cut it. And especially if I'm just going to be a mom and homeschool. But if I'm just going to be a mom and send my kids to school, it's the same thing. Well, how engaged are you going to be in their instruction? How much of a protection are you going to be? And it's with the parents first. And any school is a tool of the parents, an extension of the parents. And if you're a teacher, want to be a really, really effective tool, more effective than the parents could be. But you want to work with them and with their authority. Now, we all have no excuse when it comes to verbal art forms. We are people of the word. That's it. We are people of the word. How did God give us his commentary on his story? With words. Here it is. This is his chosen art form. That's scripture. How did he give us the actual art? So we have the commentary on the art, and we have the actual art around us. How did he do that? He spoke. This is verbal art all around us. God speaking. You know, God's haiku, God's epic poetry, God's miniaturist painting with words. And then he gives us something else. The Bible. Words. More words. And then he even goes so far as to say, you know, equating the Son of God with the Word. We've got no excuse there. You know, they might not have had acrylic paints in the BC times when David was out trying to cultivate his art. They didn't have that for King David, but they had words. And secondary to that is music. That's the other place where we have no excuse. Like, those things have always existed and always will exist. As long as there has been creation, there has been verbal art. And the first thing we've been given in imitation of that is our own verbal art, our own verbal communication, the gift of language. And the first thing Adam does is he has to write a poem. He has to name something. He has to shape something in the air, sound waves, they are physical, three-dimensional ripples in the air, which will accurately represent this thing, this woman, this mother of humanity. It's the first task he's given, is to actually begin to execute his own verbal art. There's no schooling there for him either. It was just, you're on the spot, bud. That's, you know, and here we go. And then also, now that you've done that one, go off and do that to everything. Go do that everywhere. And that charge is still true. When it comes to verbal art, we cannot avoid that. You might not have, you know, a paint on canvas curriculum going. You should want to. You should want to get that. But you might not have it. But you can never not have this. You know, your kids should be trained in wordsmithery. They should love words. They should love to play with words. They should love to rip words apart, tear them down, build them up. They should be servants, people of the word. And all of us have to be. And this is just a simple requirement. Even if you don't write poems, do you live one? Are you one? Do you have freedom within your poem? Yeah, absolutely. Which means you have to have a narrative sensibility. Because are you making choices day to day? Do I go left or do I go right? And I think that frequently, it's an aesthetic decision. That would be a garbage story. That would make me a terrible character. This would make me the righteous character. This is me choosing right. This is me living the correct story. And of course, this is very close to my heart, because when I proposed to my wife, the only reason why she said yes was because of that. She thought about all the characters that she loved and admired, because I proposed really early on in our relationship, and I was asking her to leave the ocean and move inland and many other drastic things. And she's thinking to me basically, which character would she rather be? Does she want to be the one who runs, who's scared, who hides, who's timid, or the one who jumps? And that's why she made her choice. Like, so this is close for me. Don't criticize it. At least not when she's around. She's not here, so you can do it a little bit. Now, honestly, verbal art, we should just be absolutely intense there. Now, we're going to get to, like, how. Like, what do we do? How do we even go after this? But that's, in my opinion, a given. That's a given. We have got to tackle this. We have to have students who love it. Some of them will be great. Some of them will be not so great. But they should all love it. They should all be eager. They should all strive to understand, to criticize, to shape, to build. Now, weirdly, and again, music, I'm hardly a music expert, but music is the same, you know, the same thing. And it shouldn't surprise you, although it still might, that most of the horrible, nasty pop singers on the top 40 were raised in the church. So, you know, I kissed a girl and I liked it. Pastor's kid. You know, that's a female singer. And so on. Pastor's kid. Where did Britney Spears first encounter music? You know, in the church. Where did all of these people first encounter music? Why do they have any kind of musical savvy? And the rest, you know, the truly secular kids who grow up in little atheist homes and never go to church, why do the Christian kids have an advantage when it comes to singing dirty sexual songs on the radio? Because they sang Amazing Grace first. It's like, so we are further ahead than we think, that's a weird way to spin that. We are further ahead than we think. We still have more musical training than the rest of the world, which means that they have to hire our good little kids to come sing their dirty ditties. There's a whole different topic there, but it's there. Music is required. Words are required of us. Now, art in the classical structure, bizarrely, art is one subject in our schools that is rarely subjected to A, successful worldview analysis, and B, the classical model of instruction. Now, this is difficult because if you show them a Rubens painting and you want to actually talk about it, you're going to get phone calls from parents saying, I heard you showed my child pictures of fat women naked. And you're going to say, yes, I did. I'm sorry. It's like, so there's a delicate political situation as you look through the history of art. And it shouldn't surprise you that the history of art is compromising artists. You know, artist slaves who turn into revolutionaries really, really quickly. And revolutionaries and panderers. Revolutionaries who think they're revolutionaries, but they're just pimps. And we've got a lot of those, too. But that's true through the history of Christian art. You see people who did great stained glass work, and then you look at their other stuff, and you're thinking, you know, what exactly were we thinking? The poetry of John Donne, for example. There's a lot in there that you sort of say, what? You know, why are we writing this? How is this okay? And it's not okay. But there's a huge upside, and then there's the compromise, the pandering that goes on. How do we tackle this in the classical structure? In a new school, or any school, it's really, really easy to be dogmatic about math. It's like, I'm sorry, kid. X equals 3. That's it. I don't care if your dad calls me because X equals 3. End of story. But it's a little more difficult when you say, that painter's terrible. And then they say, that's in my dining room. And you say, that painting's terrible. It's like, how are you dogmatic? It's like when you're dogmatic about math, well, that's okay. You're dogmatic about art, suddenly you're being really rude to a lot of people. We have that coffee table book. I love that movie. That's my dad's favorite movie. It's like, we watched that last night. My mom cried. It's like, that's suddenly that starts to happen. And there's a lot of delicacy involved, which shouldn't scare you off. In the face of all that, you can abdicate and just say, okay, we're not touching art. We're going to leave all of our kids vulnerable to media from the world because that won't be a problem at all. We're not going to address the fact that they're listening as soon as they get home to that stuff. They're watching on the weekends that stuff, that they want to be that when they grow up because that's what they've been told by the storytellers of our culture. We're just going to leave. How about, can we just build 3 walls to this school and we'll leave the backside just open? Will that work out, please? So I can just stop getting phone calls. If you're a teacher, you have to get yourself on the same page with your administration. And then you have to get yourself equipped for lots and lots of aesthetic arguments. Because you have to be an aesthetic expert. That's it. You have to be able to say, I'm sorry, Thomas Kincaid is a pack of lies. There you go. But it's kind of cute, which is why it's a pack of lies. So is it okay to have a kind of cute painting? Sure. Is it okay to have popcorn with fake butter? Yes, it's okay. Is it okay to have popcorn with fake butter and say, this is steak? No, it's not. So yeah, you can have a Thomas Kincaid painting. Fine. You can have one. It's kind of cute. You know, it might work in the bathroom without wallpaper. But it's popcorn with fake butter. It's box mac and cheese. Okay, we don't have a weird moral code. We don't have a weird dietary code. And there shouldn't be a weird dietary code for your eyes either. It's like, you know, it's goodness, righteousness, and so on. But you can eat box mac. I love box mac. Slice some hot dogs. Throw it in there. But don't pass it off as something else. Don't give me a corn dog and call it a Tuscan pig in a Tuscan blanket. You know, it's just, it doesn't work. So there you go. I'm showing you how to kind of offend people already. That's bad. When your kids come to school and they say, Batman was awesome. Do not, and especially with junior high kids, do not ever say, yeah, I know, right? You know, it shouldn't happen. Tear that thing to shreds. Tear it down, which means you have to have watched it, which means you have to be able to. It's like it's kind of frightening. I don't want to watch that. It makes me jump. And then it's like, well, find another art teacher. You know, find another worldview teacher. Because honestly, this kind of stuff should be happening not just in an art classroom. This should be happening in your logic classroom. Your logic teacher has to be equipped to do this. This should be happening in your theology class. Your Bible teacher should be equipped to say, I am Batman, and I have asthma. You should be able to go after it. Now, you also should know why it's compelling. Why is this compelling? Why is this effective? Why are all my kids wanting to run after that? Why are all my kids idolizing Batman and not Elijah? It's like, well, if Batman's imitating Elijah successfully, you're fine. Point out how those things work. Point out the connections. But if it's he's running because they need me to run, what was that? They like Batman because this is a grown man with billions of dollars who wears a cape, dresses like a bat, and sneaks through people's windows at night. I mean, this is what is going on. You have to be able to attack. But first, you have to be willing to have all those awkward conversations where you say, actually, you know what? John Milton was a moron. And then a lot of the aesthetes, especially the people who love the pinnacles of Christian artistic achievement and so on, say, what? We can't do that. We have to just give them Paradise Lost and say, this is wonderful. Because this is wonderful Christian art. It's amazing. There's many, many things that are wonderful about it, but you have to be able to say, actually, you got Satan completely wrong, and he's a heretic, and he was kind of effeminate and didn't play sports. And then Adam, at the beginning, he imitates himself. His description of Adam is a description of himself. Long, flowing ringlets, very gentle. You're like, that's Milton. And he was called the Lady of Christ because he was the great wuss of his college. Now, did he achieve? Yes. It's an amazing thing. But don't feel like you have to just say, rah, rah, go our team. It's like you go into it and you earn your kids' trust because you criticize our own achievements. This is a great Christian poem. We need to know how to admire it and how to, you know, break it down. Where do we find the weaknesses? And all of this is, it's kind of, hopefully, as daunting as saying, we have to teach Latin. That means somebody has to learn Latin. It's like a lot of classical schools have faced that problem. We want the kids to learn Latin. Haha. So what does that mean about us? We have to do it as well. So be willing to get into the big fights and be dogmatic about art, which means you also have to be willing to be wrong and back off and oops, sorry, yeah, I missed that in the story. You're right. That changes it. It's like you have to be willing to have that argument and potentially lose that argument. It's not math. It's not that easy. Now moving, just jumping into the grammar, dialectic, rhetoric phase of this whole thing. Be dogmatic, be confident, and you want them to be the same thing, and you hopefully want them to surpass you. Because nobody taught you this when you were growing up. So as a school and as a teacher, depending on where you are, you should shuffle things. Now, I have talked to a lot of art teachers who are MFAs and so on. And as a result, they have a level of sophistication in worldly art, but they still haven't really given much thought to how to teach it or even their own standards for why they like this and don't like that. They have, I am moved by this. I am not moved by that. Fireproof is cheesy. So I have a problem with it, as opposed to any kind of substantive criticism. But if you're dealing with the grammar phase, something I have run into that's bothered me in getting my kids art instruction, and my kids are all in the grammar phase. The thing that bothers me is that these are baby birds. They have all the discernment of baby birds at this point. What does this mean for any and all art instruction? Do not, under any circumstances, make them sing garbage, read garbage, or paint garbage. It's like, why would you? And I would say, and I wouldn't call this garbage, but for example, should you take six-year-old and say, this is Starry Night by Van Gogh. We're going to imitate this. Everybody start dabbing. Where does Impressionism fit in the history of art? Where does it fit in the skill set of art? Like, think about the application of that phase of education to every other subject. What should you be learning? We should be learning rules. Rules and rules. We should be looking at that, and you know, little kids should be looking at that saying, what's in the foreground? You know, what's going on with the balance of the canvas? Learn rules, rules, rules. You know what the hard part is? Painting something that actually looks like something else. That's hard. That's difficult. How do you hold your brush? How do you plan a painting? How do you structure this thing? You shouldn't be imitating impressionists. Now, eventually, I've got no problem with impressionism, you know, or even abstract art done with the right mentality, the right goals, the right worldview. But the question is, how do you get there? Should kindergartners write free verse? It's the same question. This is free verse on a canvas. It's like, what do they get first? The skeleton, the bones, the beats. How does the language work? Let's get this stuff. Let's get these rhythms into these kids. Treat them like they're little birds with their mouths wide open, because that's what they are. And you want them to get all sorts of things that they're not going to know how they learned later, but they're just going to know them. It's like, this is your chance. So what are the rules? Which means you have to learn lots of rules. You have to understand aesthetic theory when it comes to pictures. You know, you have to actually know all about meter yourself. If you're going to ever get them to the point where they can write good free verse, they've got to start there. So with little kids, all too often, a school says, oh, isn't that parent artsy? I think I remember her being artsy. Let's have her come in and teach the kids how to paint. Which means somebody comes in really well-meaning. You know, can be the kids can love her or him. They're going to be a great classroom experience. And they're saying, hey, kids, look at today's God-hating work. Let's all try that. And everybody, all over the canvas. And then, you know, they'll hold up the different things and say, wow, nice work, Johnny. you're really expressing yourself. Because that's what happens at the college level, right? It's all about ripping your own ribcage open and burying your soul. It's like mechanics. It's like just rules. You make them sing songs about other stuff. You know, you get them to know the rules so that they'll have them later without even thinking about it. Now, my favorite part, my favorite kids to deal with are in the dialectic. This is where teachers get scared, and they should be. And you all have probably heard horror stories about logic instruction where you end up with some kid, some little dolt out there who learned everything, and now he just takes me down every time. So I try to say something about the history of the West, and he says, you realize you're affirming the consequent. He says, you just want to strangle him, which means you're doing your job. You've done your job well. They're going to hold you to your own standard. They're learning the rules of logic. They should be learning theology. They should be learning all these things. And all of these things should be integrating in their art instruction. This is when you want Johnny the Baby Bird to turn into Johnny the Destroyer. That's what you want. It's like you're saying to Johnny, be really, really mean to this right here. Pick it to pieces. What's wrong with it? Tear it to shreds. No, really, you get to. What do you really think of Paradise Lost, Johnny? And go after it. But you have to back up your opinions. It can't just be Johnny the fusser, Johnny the one who kind of, it's really, really lame. That's not cool. The words sound old. So that doesn't work. They should be taking everything they're learning in the other classes, worldview stuff, philosophy, logic, and then all the mechanics, the theory, you know, the principles of art that they've actually been gaining when they were younger, and then they begin to apply. You give them a hatchet and you say, go to it. Take it apart. Did anybody see Batman? What do you think of Batman? Train them to go after stuff aggressively. Not to be intimidated, not to be cowed, frequently to be as respectful as is necessary. If there's great achievement in a piece, you want to teach them to, you know, actually leave that alone. Which means you have to be there saying, actually, no, your hatchet blows don't work here, and here's why. This is valid. This is legitimate. You have to be really, really engaged, really, really competent yourself. Bring on the garbage here. Don't try to protect these kids from garbage. Don't try to make them grow up in a bubble where they are unaware that art out there is terrible, where they're unaware that you have a worldview problem with what Hollywood's trying to do. Don't just try to ignore it and then release them with no immune system into the world upon graduation. It just doesn't work out, actually. Bring on the garbage. Bring them stuff to fight. Bring girls that you think, you know, have bad attitudes about stuff and they need to learn to be more positive. It's like, no, this is their chance to learn how to be negative. This is that window. Bring it on. Bring on the garbage scavenger hunts. Do not expect the student to ingest anything whole anymore, or even pre-chewed. Teach them appropriate disrespect. Teach them to be unintimidated. It's like they shouldn't be afraid of going after anything, because they're going after it and they're comparing it to everything you've taught them, hopefully, means that they're going after it and comparing it to the art of God, to the Word of God, to God's aesthetic theory. Not arbitrary fashion that you picked up when you audited a couple MFA classes. Not something from a book that's really, really fad-driven right now, but ancient, true principles of art. The things that have lasted. The things that span centuries. They have these things now, hopefully, and now they can really, really be rude. Teach them to root through Van Gogh, Milton, Shakespeare, and Batman like pigs rooting for problematic truffles. And then begin to teach them to hold their own work to the same standard. And this is where it suddenly gets painful. That's kind of the transition phase between the dialectic and the rhetoric. It's like there's, at some point, like you have to be consistent here. If you're going to really criticize something, you need to be able to stand up and take criticism as well. So teach them to respect what is something that's respectable, and teach them to just go after stuff that's not. And then we move into reality check. Okay, so hold up your own stuff. You know, like what's wrong with your own stuff? Now the phase here, this is the bridge that's actually can be quite difficult to to straddle is, you know, there's a real futility and discouragement that comes when kids have wide open eyes about quality, and then they start to look at their own creations. It's like, then it can just be crushing. You know, I remember going through this, you know, eighth grade or so, thinking like, man, that doesn't sound like C.S. Lewis at all. You know, and how could it? Like, could you expect it to? You know, I also remember working on one short story and slaving on it, I think also in eighth grade, and right when I was starting to move into the direction of creating, trying to describe flame. It's like I have this image in my head. I was trying to describe it. Like, how do you describe fire? And then coming to the point where it's like, dancing. That's original. It's dancing firelight. Nobody's ever said that. It's perfect. And I still remember like the, oh, I got it. And then starting to see that, you know, three or four times in every book I read for some reason. Like, what's the problem? Like, realization dawning as I was beginning to criticize what I was reading. Why can't this guy come up with a new way of you know, this doesn't exactly work out. So there's a lot of frustration. There's heavy, heavy frustration in the exit of the dialectic because they're trying to learn to create for themselves. There's a total fear, understandably, of holding their own work up in front of a classroom of people who've been trained to rip things to shreds. You know, so how do you handle this? How do you go about it? And it's really, really difficult because you have to be honest with them. You know, I've had students on the college level who tell me, I'm going to be a writer. That's what I'm going to do because I'm really good at writing. I say, oh, great, fabulous. You'll do well here in this class then. And then I get the first paper and I say, no, you're not going to be. It's not going to happen. And there's a major meltdown because every teacher was an encourager. And some of these are homeschool kids, some of these are private school kids, whose teachers lied to them about their own quality. They never got criticism. They never learned how to take something apart and rebuild it. They never learned how to actually have something crossed out and read and say, throw away. It didn't happen. It was just, oh, good. Keep going. You're talented. Keep going. Go, go, go. Because it's, once again, delicate. So these kids have a vision that surpasses their ability to create. And this is, you have a, you know, a window of a couple. You don't have to get them to the point where they're publishable authors. You don't have to get them to the point where they're gallery ready. But you have to get them to the point where they're encouraged enough to go after it. They see improvement. They see their own work being bettered. And nobody just shuts down. No one shuts down. But the truth is, if somebody's really, really bad, but they have all the vision, well, congratulations, you have an art critic. Not everybody is going to be good at creating. It's like, so everybody has to be able to chew and tear apart and analyze. They all do if they're going to be students. It's like if these are going to be people that you want to put your stamp on and say, yeah, they understand the world in the light of Scripture. It's like they can attack everything around them and process and accept or deny everything in terms of worldview and theology and so on. That the criticism side is required. Appreciating creation is part of that. So you want them to go through and in the rhetoric phase attempt to create their own stuff. But you're going to have kids who clearly are gifted and other kids who are clearly going to go do something else. And how do you encourage all of them while at the same time not pretending like there isn't a difference? Because there is. And there's a very public difference. Again, in math, the kids might compare grades, but you don't. You don't stand up and say, this kid has 104 for the seventh straight test, which means you have too much extra credit. This kid, congratulations, everybody, right here, he passed. Finally. You know, you don't do that. But with art, it's up there. You know, their performance is, you know, it's out there. But the same is true of sports. Same is true of drama. That kid can hit a free throw. That kid can't. Like, you have to learn how to sort through this. This is an important part of education. Kids finding their roles in the body. You know, what are they gifted at? And so on. They should all try to create. They should all be going after it, trying to learn to shape, trying to learn to imitate, and so on. But not all of them are going to become excellent here, which means your grading is going to be interesting. You know, how do you grade? And so on. It still has to be fairly intellectual in its grading. It can't be achievement-based grading for painting. It's like there's going to be, you know, merit for diligence and so on, because you can't just say, well, sorry, we just ruined your 4-point, because, well, you just can't do a horse. Didn't work. Looked a little bit bovine. You know, put that in the transcript that goes off to colleges. You can't do that. But this is where you need creators. You need people who can create in the classroom, working with them, workshopping stuff, helping these people stand up, tearing them down themselves. Like, yeah, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? And so on. And other students can be learning how to actually be humble while being excellent. It's like, and other people are learning how to be diligent and driven and humble while not being excellent. It's difficult. It's like, it really is, but welcome to the world. The world isn't as egalitarian as we would like it to be. And yes, we would like it to be. Even though we say that's one of those, you know, worldly lies, we still act that way. And I know we do, because I see these kids who all show up and say, I'm a wonderful writer. I'm excited. My teacher always gave me A's. Yeah, then I frequently, and other times, I've met the teachers, which is always interesting. They're like, yeah, they really struggled. And you have this weird problem. You have to be honest. And you have to learn to be honest and kind. So that goes back to your dialectic. You know, where do you show respect? How do you show respect? How do you show respect to a Christian brother who is trying to do something really, really good and still failed? Do you pretend like he didn't? Is it just go team, our quarterback's perfect? No, actually, that was an interception. You know, he flubbed that one. Still like him. You know, still understand what he's doing. Still better than I am. But that was a goof. We have to be able to do that. I personally think that one of the greatest threats to our students coming out of ACCS schools is that they are wicked smart, highly educated, and unprepared for the strongest attack that the world has, which means that they get recruited quickly. You know, it happens fast. It's like, wow, you have talent. You've read Shakespeare. Come with us, please. It's like, and we're going to put you right into our machine. You can write the next really bad franchise film for us. It's like, that's where you're going to end up going. Or, wow, you really love art. You have a great understanding of the history of art, unlike every other art student who's come to this art institute. So, you know, we're going to really plug you in. Come on down to your new drawing class. You know, let's go. Let's get you plugged in. Let's start chasing, you know, this particular dream. Let's have you go to Prague and get really thoughtful and full of ennui. It's like, that's how do you prepare them for that? I mean, yeah, you have to have really independent students, really unintimidated students, really, really confident students, and not just students who can see a fallacy when it's written for them in an analytical argument, but who can spot a fallacy when it's wearing a bat cape, when there's big million-dollar effects behind it. You know, people who can love books, but they're not vacuum cleaners. They can tell you why Harry Potter is philosophically inconsistent, because they actually know about the ontology of good and evil from those other classes, which means your teachers also know and can integrate stuff from other classes. This is how it has to be. You cannot create really, really, really good tools for the world. Not preparing them here is like making them really, really sharp and dangerous and then attaching a handle and just holding it out there and letting the world grab on. You know, I've known kids who were that smart, really, really well trained, and unfortunately, no artistic immune system was in place. You know, and I talked to him on a break, you know, they'd be back from a freshman year in college somewhere, and I could talk to him on a break and have them just say, wow, that place was amazing. I love that place. Have you ever heard of this guy called Tarantino? You know, my RA took me down and we watched all of his movies one night straight through and he explained them to me. And it's like, you know, just, you know, fall over. It's like somebody saying, have you ever heard of this thing called alcohol? My parents never told me about it. My school never admitted that it existed. But I feel different. It's the same kind of thing. That's the way it goes. Prepare your students. Which means in the early phases, when you go after it, when you're trying to teach the mechanics, not only are you going to be trying to learn at a fast, fast pace, and as parents, we should all be trying to learn this stuff anyway. But as teachers, especially, as the delegated authorities of the parents, to take responsibility for this, you should be on the fast track trying to understand this. What makes this good, and can you back it up? And I don't care, honestly, if we disagree about a given piece. What I care about is which sources do we go to? Which authorities do we appeal to? And you say, no, Kincaid is great, and here's why. And we go into, basically, we appeal to the natural world, which is God's. We appeal to Scripture, which is God's. And we don't say anything, not one thing, about secular art theory there. Like, where are our sources? Where are our authorities? And so on. Not to say that seculars don't have anything to say about structure, narrative, and so on, because they do. They stole it from us. They got it from the natural world, from Scripture, from Christian tradition. But where do we go? So be dogmatic. I'll be dogmatic. We'll collide. Let's go to the sources. Be willing to give. Be willing to concede. And honestly, you can never encourage, especially a kid in that junior high phase, you can never encourage them more than when you say, no, this is terrible. And they say, and they bring all the stuff that you taught them. And they make a compelling aesthetic case. And then you back down. You say, you know what? Actually, I think you're right. There's more value there than I thought. Or, you know what? You're right. My favorite movie is trash. It's like showing them that shouldn't be scary to you. I mean, that's contagious. That's infectious. They're going to be thrilled. It's like that's like finally giving them the donkey the carrot. It's like they're not just tilting with windmills the whole time. They can actually convince someone. They can actually compel someone. And you're teaching them how to change, how to receive at the same time. So if you tackle this, you will lose a lot of arguments. You have to be prepared to lose a lot of arguments. But the important thing is that you have them and that your sources, your authorities are in place. Because when you, honestly, especially with high school kids, I've seen this over and over and over again. When you say, let's talk about that movie, which I just overheard all of you talking about when I came in the door. It's usually going to be off-curriculum stuff that matters the most. Let's talk about that, because I knew this would happen, and I actually watched it, and I took notes. You don't tell them that part. And then you actually went up and read something about this director. They will tell you almost universally, when you go after something that they admire, that they've already set on a pedestal, and you say, well, let's break that down. That movie's really not nearly as good as you think it is. They will say very quickly, you don't understand. And they'll want to leave it there. Really? Are they right? Are they accurate? Have they, in fact, done more research in the film world than you have? Have you ever listened to this band that they're talking about? Have you listened to this music? Have you printed the lyrics out? You know, are you ready? It's like, you know what? Let's look at that. I've got my iPhone right here. Let's read this slowly. It's like, I've got a John Donne poem right here, and here's this song, which you admire so much. Let's read and compare. Are you prepared? Are you ready to do that? Are you ready to go there? They'll say you don't understand. No, you don't understand. I heard there was this interview, because somebody told me about it once. I think there was this interview where the guy said this is a Christian movie, and he was trying to bring out, you know, Christian themes. And you say, actually, no, it was about Islam. And they made him change it to Christianity at the end because they were worried about backlash. You know, blink, blink, blink. Where did you get that? It's all available to you. You know, it's out there. Research it. You know, you want to be actually in a position where you can say, no, I do understand. And that's what's going to happen over and over. You don't understand. And if they're right, they know it. They will know it very, very quickly. Finally, to wrap up here, honestly, I think there's so much more to do in developing, you know, an actual art curriculum. I'm not interested in the details of how that's executed. but it's obvious to me that the classical model applies to it very, very directly. And that a few schools are doing it well. But most schools, it's a big, scary place where they can alienate parents and anger students and be incompetent as instructors. And that's why the world pours through that breach in the wall, affecting, influencing your students, taking them from you. But if we're successful here, you build that wall and you teach them to build that wall, it'll fly up fast. Not everyone has to be a great artist, but they all have to be as good as they can be. Then, you know, a lot of them won't be great. Most of them won't be great. It's the nature of greatness. All of them must be as good as they can be, which means that all of them have to be unintimidated. unintimidated by the world and its products. And part of that is that means not running off and refusing to engage. Refusing to watch movies because they're dangerous is another form of intimidation. Watching them and groveling, well, you're intimidated, you're cowed. Both happen. You know, the alternative is instruction, engagement, preparation. Kids who are unintimidated can be really dangerous students. They can be unfriendly to the institution. They can make you feel uncomfortable mid-lecture. That's what you want, because the same thing is going to happen to those college professors. Same thing is going to happen to the world, except for they're going to get bigger and bolder and stronger. And they're going to go out there and they're going to leave a real crater. And that's what you want. Students are going to leave a real crater. Not just survive, but actually influence and damage those around them. Ultimately, we can get back to art dominance. If you look around at the world's art and say, wow, that's terrible, so stop being afraid. It is terrible. How hard is it going to be to beat? How difficult should this be? That's going to take a generation, two, three, max. But we really should get back to the point where we are in a position of art dominance, where we're not just training their pop singers, but we're doing much, much more than that, where they look to our architecture again, our painters again, our storytellers again. And that's what we want. Thank you very much.